All right. Hello, hello, and welcome to Convos and Cocktails, where we talk, you engage, and we all drink. I'm your host, Lesego Tlhabi, and on today's episode, we have constitutional lawyer. I mean, she's got a lot of titles, to be honest, but I do first and foremost know her as a constitutional lawyer, Lwando Xwaso. And she's also, are you the sole creator of Including Society?
Yes.
Okay.
I would say I am.
cool, own it. And we'll also be using her book to discuss a few topics around race, reconciliation, inclusion in South Africa, using incidents that have happened in our schools to create the conversation. But first, before we begin, the cocktail on today's menu is called a Johnny Ginger. Am I getting that right?
Yes, because it's supposed to have Johnny Walker
and ginger. I mean, it's just ginger because you're not drinking. Why are you not drinking?
I want the long answer or the short one?
The quickest, I guess.
I've never really had a love for alcohol.
Okay.
I think in my very later years, I discovered a love for gin and tonic,
mm-hmm.
and then for champagne. And then I would drink those occasionally.
Yeah.
And then I went to my last gynae appointment. I pride myself that I've never had fibroids.
Okay.
She told me, oh, I see a small one developing, and I completely panicked. And I'm such a believer in acidity, alkalinity. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to move away from anything acidic until my next gynae appointment, because then I want to report back to you that the fibroid is
gone.
Because
okay.
I'm not going to have any operation that I don't need to have. I've seen people
go. I love
that. No, I just can't. And all of my friends have had fibroids and have had operations. So that kind of scared me. It's like anything that I'm not really committed to, like alcohol, I don't even want to do occasionally if it could contribute to the growth of that thing. So that's why I'm not drinking with you today.
I mean, I'm not drinking either. I do what my guest does. So I just basically, we've got a cup of Chimera because that's all it tastes like to me. I'm not that big a fan of ginger.
Nostalgia in a cup.
Yeah. But anyway, cheers. Welcome to Convos and Cocktails. Thank you so much.
It's also professional, hey?
I am
like
professional.
That intro.
On the Why are you doubting
You're born
my professionalism?
No, it was cool hearing that intro. It's like we were chatting one moment, next thing you're like in.
On.
Yeah, like, okay, I guess we've started.
I mean, basically, but I also do want it to feel like a chat. I don't want it to feel too much like a interview.
Awesome.
But I do want to speak, first and foremost, I began reading your book. Mostly today, because there was this chapter on coconuts that I just thought, like, oh, it was written for me. Oh my God, I can't believe how much I just relate to the stuff in your book. But Lwando's book is called Made in South Africa, A Black Woman's Stories of Rage, Resistance, and Progress. So before we get into conversations on the country and fixing those problems, please tell us why you decided to write this book.
One thing you said is that you went to a particular story in the book, and I wrote this as a number of essays, because I don't expect everyone to read chronologically. People don't have time, but I hope someone will pick it up, see one of the names of the essays, and be like, I feel like that's something I need right now. And it's a book that I think you can read over the course of your life, depending on what it is you need to hear. And, well, the reason why I wrote it is that a publisher asked me to.
Okay. That's really fair. It's the same as mine. Some people are like, why coconut cows? Why now? I'm like, girl, because they came.
Exactly. But the other thing is maybe not feeling like I embody the title of writer, of author. It felt too big. It's not something I wanted. But I had been doing like a weekly column for the Daily Maverick. And I had actually started writing for them and other publications around 2013.
Yeah.
It was a time that I'd come back from studying in the US. So I had all this pent-up stuff that I wanted to release. It was also the era of Jacob Zuma. So it felt like we were all just, you know, howling at the wind. And the publisher came to me, I think, late 2019. After I had, like, avoided all the emails, I saw them coming in. They're like, we want you to write a book. First of all, at that time, I didn't have any time to write a book. I don't want to commit to anything. But then when she emailed for, like, the third time, I was like, okay, I'll do a coffee date, which is always, okay, commitment. I'll show up, listen to you.
That's the best I can do.
It's the best I can do. But when she told me her idea, I was like, I actually thought about this as an idea for a book, because one of my favorite books is called When We Were 8 Years in Power by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he's a columnist for The Atlantic.
Okay.
And in that book, he collates all the essays he wrote under the Obama era, and he does like fresh introductions to each essay to kind of describe where he was when he was writing them. So the publisher said to me, we just want to collect all your essays. And I'm like, no, we're going to collect the essays. I'm going to do a fresh introduction to each of them, because some of them maybe I feel differently about, and I want to put that into context. But also it was like there's some stuff that I never published that are either in my journals, or I've just I do this thing where if I need, you know, to process something, I'll send an email just to my friends.
Okay.
So, for instance, the one about Zuma Must Fall is a pure reflection from my journal that I sent to my friends over email, I think your mom included. And it's just how I, you know, in a moment of feeling maybe really despondent, that's how I get back to a point of connection, is writing a note to my friends. So the Zuma Must Fall is a new one that's never been published anywhere. There are a couple of those that are like that. So, and then the pandemic happened. It's like, well, you've got time.
Exactly.
So I think it was a confluence of timing and the ease of the structure of the book, having the meat, the meat of it, and just having to add a little bit. Yeah.
So I did say I went to the coconut chapter first, but that's not to say it's the only chapter I read, because I read about your incident in PE with ice cream shop. I read about your childhood when, you know, like I said, the coconut chapter where the boy bullied you. So the thing I like the most about people who want to call themselves non-writers who actually are writers is that the story is so easy to read, because it sounds like someone's just speaking to you. There's no flowery language. There's no, oh, but my metaphors, what. So, in first of all, your memory as well. My God. The things that you remember. I don't remember what happened last weekend, let alone when I was three.
I used to journal as a kid, because I don't know what happened first, whether it was my first therapy session. I was way ahead of my time. My mom took me to therapy at 12.
Mom, yes.
Oh, no. But then after my therapy session, she went in. And also my therapist was my aunt.
You see, now she's like, yeah, we're at depression. When are you going to wash the dishes?
So the idea was there. She didn't quite know this therapy world. My aunt was a therapist, so that's where I started. So the journaling has always been a part of my life. So I think that helps with memory.
Okay.
But also the coconut incident was just a formative experience. It just shaped who I am. And it kind of just stamped me as someone who wasn't found to be acceptable in that environment, so it's kind of like you think you have your people, and then a moment, because then you come from like Emerentia Primary, which is the school I went to, which was well integrated but still very white, and feeling like, I've found my tribe at school, but it's still, I go to the suburbs, I don't live there, and it's not entirely me. I'm sure the kids on my street accept me, know me, but that was a reminder that they don't either. So it was an incident of physical violence. So I remember that, because I got physically violent, and that doesn't happen quite often. And I remember how I felt after beating this boy who called me a coconut, that I never want to be driven to that point ever again. And I think it informs my approach to a lot of things today, that I don't like physical violence.
Yeah.
I understood why it happened, but I just don't constantly want to operate from that space.
So I want to ask you why the work you do, like why you do the work you do. The fact that you're in, you were or are a constitutional lawyer, and the fact that you work so hard with reconciliation, with matters of diversity and inclusion. Your company is called Including Society.
Yeah.
Why not Inclusion Society?
Well, there are distinctions, and I mean, you're hitting on something around language that I have a problem over. You know, a lot of people say I do diversity and inclusion work because that's what the market understands.
Yeah.
But once I show up with the interventions I have in mind, they may not be your traditional diversity workshops, which I hate, and I'm not even quite settled on the word. If you go to my website, you will see that there's a part of it where I define the terms for myself, so that we're clear that I'm operating from this definition of diversity, representation, inclusion, and all those things. But even that, I think, needs an overhaul, because I'm not quite too sure how useful those words are. When I did the whole branding thing, the people I was working with kind of, you know, directed me towards those words because they make sense in terms of starting a business. But for me, it's more doing community building work, relationship building. Reconciliation is a big word, but I know in South Africa it's like a highly charged word. Restorative justice is part of it. you know, we work a lot with, I was actually talking, I do have a partner in Including Society in this part of it where we offer these interventions. Her name is Savanthika. And I met Savanthika during that September in 2019. I'm sure you can remember that week where we found out what happened to Uyinene.
Yeah.
And then xenophobic violence also sprang up all at the same time. So I was feeling crushed underneath the weight of all of this. And I needed to create something. I wanted to respond to that moment by creating a space of healing for people. Because the last time we had that in South Africa, I joined a march,
mm-hmm.
which is where I was at the time. But this time around, it was such a deep sadness. And I was scared that I was feeling such a deep disconnection that I was trying to do the opposite of that. Because as Savanthika says, where there's disconnection, there's fear.
Yeah.
Or where there's fear, there's disconnection. So I wanted to be with people who were seeking the same thing as me. So I put out a call for facilitators, psychologists who could come and see people at Conhill who were feeling the way I was feeling and sort of like counsel them through that. That's how I met her. And when I watched her process, it wasn't like about being woke or having an intellectual panel discussion or, you know, just a lot of what you see online. It wasn't about that. It was literally saying we're feeling like a defeated people. Mm. What's happening? Why did this happen to Uyinene? Why do we keep having xenophobia, violence? And also, how do I take care of myself at this time?
Yeah.
I saw her process and I completely loved it. So a lot of my work is informed by psychology, by the kind of coaching and facilitation that she does. And I bring my legal background, even though I feel like my legal background has limitations. Mm-hmm. That's why I left law. And that's why I do the work that I do, because the last legal job that I had, I signed an NDA that lets you know that it wasn't the best parting of ways. Yeah. And it was because of a lot of these issues that we're kind of talking about now, the undertones of, you know, feeling... working at a white firm and just feeling like you're just always in constant opposition.
Yeah.
And it feeling like, I mean, in that scenario, you know, I worked for someone difficult. And I remember I was like, I'm going to mirror her energy. How she shows up that day is how I'm going to show up.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be even more extra. But at the end of the day, it was leaving me feeling drained and alienated from who I was. I didn't like it.
Mm.
And then I remember reading a book called A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson, which reminded me of my values. And I'm like, I'm going to love this person.
I love her out of her shit. Sorry, hold on. Okay.
It's the ginger.
It is. It's bringing, I don't know what, the flu season. Oh, God, now my head.
It's like stony, you know, it stays
like
here. Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay, so I want to speak specifically about the work that you do with schools, because we've been seeing a lot in the news. I mean, not recently, just...
always.
Always.
Mm.
About racism in schools, racism in varsity. I saw, I don't know if it's in your book or I saw an article, but you were speaking about the incidents with Kuro.
In 2015, it's in the book.
And you see, I read.
Thank you.
And then how that kind of got you to a point where you were like, okay, something's got to be done.
Mm.
And I think there was another school in Pretoria, no, that was Pretoria, another school in the Northwest that also had, you know, incidents of racism. So just to ask, and I know you don't have all the answers, but I feel like if there's a guiding light that I always turn to in these moments, it's you. So,
oh, thank you.
No, like legit, your page is and your work is just incredible. I can't speak enough about it. But why do you think we're at this point in 2015, 2016, we know Pretoria Girls High with the hair thing. All the schools came out 2 years ago with their incidents of racism. Why are we still here?
Let me ask you a question, because you went to one of these schools. And I want to know, when you were, or looking back, actually, what do you think the point of your schooling life was? Not what they said it was about, but what it felt like it was about.
Grooming wives for the boys that went to schools. Next to us, like literally, it was like everything we did was to get etiquette and to get manners and to then pluck a husband out of Hilton and you guys go to varsity and get married, like either in varsity or straight out of varsity. It felt like a finishing school to me, and it felt very much about maintaining the privilege. So that's why it was important that it's a Hilton boy or a Michael House boy, not just a boy from
keeping it in the family.
Exactly. Everything, it was very much about that elitism, classism, maintaining that thing. Your kids also go, there were kids who's like three generations worth of St. Anne's kids. And I was like, well, my grandmother wasn't here. My mother wasn't here for sure.
Yeah.
And so I think it was for me about that. Like,
why didn't that work for you?
Well, because I went to St. Anne's, I think, more, I don't want to say woke, but I was very a Joburg kid. I was much more aware of, like, the shit that was happening. I do think woke is maybe the word that I was starting to feel in high school. And I had many incidents of chaos and fighting incidents because I was just like, this is not how the world works, guys. This little farm where we just, like, maintain privilege and, like, where races can't date each other. I mean, I had situations at St. Anne's where people would talk about, oh, we don't date across, you know, the kind of line kind of thing. And I was like, in 2006, even in 2006, that was crazy to me. So I can't imagine now, but it was just coming from Joburg. I think I was just more aware that, like, we do mix in Joburg. And people, my first boyfriend was white. I mean, boyfriend is a strong word, but, like, my first little thing was white. And everybody was mixing. And we had interracial friends and multiracial friendship groups. It wasn't a thing. Race was very much a thing at St. Anne's. And I just was very shocked about it. About how backwards they were.
And were there some
students... Not you turning this into your podcast.
No, we're getting to it.
Oh, we're doing it like a facilitation thing. Okay,
no,
okay.
No, it's not even. I'm just interested because I feel like there are people who buy into that, right? For them, it's like, oh, this is a great plan. My life is sorted. I'm going to go to the school, gain access, gain entry.
Exactly.
And
now
that's,
you know,
my life.
The CEO of Investec or whatever it is like
the
Hilton boy 1950. So he's like, oh.
What are the rewards?
I mean, access, like you said. It really, it does put a different view on people's faces when you go to, when I was still in the job market, going to interviews and saying my
when
school.
You were in. It's so nice.
Yeah. Past tense. No, I've worked very hard to not be there. But anyway, you know, having St. Anne's on as part of you, because for me, high school shouldn't matter when you're in a job situation. There's varsity in between that, internships, a lot of experience, but it matters to a lot of people when you say the school, and it sounds like those prestigious schools. So that for me, it put me on the top of a lot of lists that probably might not have been there for me if I'd gone to a different school.
So that's why our parents send us there, right? It's because they want better for us and they think that's what better is. Yeah. But then what they don't know is how it messes you up because, you know, our parents have this thing, but you turned out fine. Look at you. You have a podcast. You did a book. You know, maybe this stuff wouldn't have happened without St. Anne. So we do these calculations. We saw each other on Saturday and the word was negotiations. Yeah. And we're always negotiating with the world. And a lot of people were like, well, if we know that these schools are like this, like, why would you go to Stellenbosch?
Yeah.
Do you know I wanted to go to Stellenbosch?
Yo, I never had that. I knew it was racist from my time.
No, I just thought, ooh, it's in Paarl. I have family in Paarl. Never mind that my family roots in Paarl was like as farm workers. But I was like, I have family in Paarl. Sounds like a quaint town. Also, I'm very traditional in my thinking because the schools I went to are very traditional. You know, you wear your blazer, you do this. And I was so scared that varsity is going to be the wild, wild west.
I needed
containment. I'm like, because I think when you grow up as a black girl, the thing is people tell you is like, you're going to get pregnant and your life is over. So what drove me is like, avoid all of that. Feel like Stellenbosch is the place I can sequester myself and be safe from all those things and actually get my degree. And I'm told they still wear a uniform there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, your question is, why do these things keep happening?
Yeah.
It's not isolated just in schools. I think schools are just a microcosm of, you know, what's happening in the
corporate
home,
and,
in corporate, in churches.
Also, I definitely want to get you in for a corporate chat, but I don't want to go to corporate now because then our time is going to be 17 hours. I want to stay with school because
If you look at the roots of like the school you went to, probably, you know, I'm sure they don't call themselves this, but I'm sure they were very much like a mission school.
Pretty much.
That it's about, even though black students probably were not allowed at the time, but even the students that they had there at the time, it's about conforming.
Mm-hmm.
It's about being disciplined. I think that that kind of education system under colonialism is to aid capitalism. How are you going to produce workers, people who are just going to do as they are told, because that's what the system needs? And also in terms of women, grooming them to play their part in a capitalist society, playing the support, playing the wife, you know.
And also in the straight world, because they even banned girls from going with other women or other girls to our formals and our matric dances. So even in a race way, but also in a misogyny, in a homophobic way.
So you're groomed for just being a worker, for being docile, you know, being loyal to those values, not thinking for yourself. All the things that we understand that school should not be about today, that you should be a critical thinker. But as you see students become critical thinkers, awoke, as they say, then all of a sudden you are going against, you know, what the school is about. Yeah. It's not celebrated. For me, like, some of these incidents are just rich moments of human interaction, and these schools are not equipped to deal with them. The teachers are in fear, the principals are worried about being cancelled or their schools ending up in the papers. There's really no personal development that people are doing to be able to exist in this world in 2022, because even the Constitutional Court says you can't hit children in school anymore, not even in the home, because we're trying to create a world where we don't enforce rules through violence and saying you can't talk back and you can't think for yourself, and if you try to, we're going to beat you up. Now it's like, without that recourse to, you know, spanking you or whatever it is, We are supposed to move into a culture of more engagement and talking and things like that. Because if we take Stellenbosch as an example, right? I wrote about it on my Instagram, and when I read the history of Stellenbosch, it's a school that was started by a mining magnate, an Afrikaans one, who profited from the diamond rush in Kimberley. Obviously, for you and I, our minds start turning when we hear that. It almost makes me, you know, shake a little bit, because...
But also, I'm not surprised by that. Because
of what it's like. By it, but I'm surprised at the fact that they just write it in that way.
Yeah.
There's no... And, like, there's no... For me, there's no pride in that. That's not an origin story you should just tell in a historical way or a political way. Is that, show me that you understand that your school being founded by someone who profited and probably planted the country through diamond mining, started this institution, has problems that can be connected to where we are today. And also, by telling the story without being critical, you're saying to that white boy who urinated on the black student's belongings that your heritage has some kind of validity, because it hasn't been questioned. So they're sitting with these simple narratives of probably Afrikaner nationalism. And I don't know if that's the case. I'm just projecting. That's what happens when we don't critically assess, you know, our history. And I can even say the same thing probably for St. Anne's, that when you look at its history, it doesn't betray an understanding of, you know, let's own up to the fact that we were founded as a white-only school. Why was that? And what must it be like for a black student who's joining an institution that existed, I don't know how many years prior you joined, that it was, you know, mostly white. And I think there's a lack of empathy from teachers, the entire school community, of what it's like for a black child to come into these systems. And also, you know, beyond just the school, you know, you go and you hope that, you know, you're going to do as, you know, you are taught to do, get your matric, you know,
put your head down and finish.
Put your head down, speak well, all the things you do, because a lot of survival hinges on the kind of school you go to. And, you know, not even for me what you learned at that school, because I think 90% of what I learned at my school is completely useless to me. It just it just didn't equip me for life. But it was about being socialized in a particular way. In your case, to be someone's wife and, you know, to be a sort of like docile woman who's going to, you know, play wife from for some successful guy. Because for me, even that is such a white colonial view still of a woman's place in society.
And the fact that one person must cook. I want to ask you, why do you think these conversations are always had simply by black people? Because I think one of the things that also got to me was that we went to the same schools, we experienced the same things. Maybe I voiced some of those things, A, whilst in school, but definitely in my character now. Why is it that white people have either an apathy or even a denial to the things that are happening?
You know, before I came here, I was talking to Savanthika, because we are currently working with such a school. But I have to tell you that the school we're working with, I feel like there is such an embrace of doing this right.
Is this from the parents and teachers, or you mean just from the students?
So far, the teachers were about to meet with the students.
Okay.
But we're even putting a lot of thought in terms of how we even approach the students and all of that. Mm-hmm. And even your school, they sent me an email. I must tell you, it was one of the best emails I've ever gotten. It was so clear. It was so comprehensive. I was like, that's so dignifying for me. It's like the respect that I got in terms of, you know, clarity in the email. So you get brought into these schools, and one of the things Savantha and I are dealing with, mm-hmm. right, we're not interested in racial literacy.
Yeah.
You can look that up yourself, what unconscious bias is and white privilege and all of that stuff. Read that on your own. It's really not that hard to understand. But I think what's happening is that there's just this veil of fear. And I think it's even outside of the schooling system. Mm-hmm. Our lives are ruled by fear, right? Even our online lives. There's so many things that I have to think twice about before I post and all those things, because I know what it can mean today, right? So imagine if you're 14 years old. And I think it's something we've both experienced some kind of backlash, you more than I have. And I'm sure that changes you once you see, you know, people not being open to engaging on maybe something you now perceive as an error that you made. It's like there's no learning together through those moments. So in a particular case that I've worked on, is it's the classic example of a white student calling another the N-word.
Okay, in South Africa.
Yes. And, and maybe that's the exercise. What comes up for you in terms of what do you want to see happen in that scenario? And these are children,
yeah,
always keep in mind.
I mean, yo, it's very difficult for me to say. I think,
and be honest, because
I think it also depends, because first of all, I just get so surprised when words that aren't even part of South African's lexicon get used in this country, and very much maybe the K word, not so much, but the N word, the we have those conversations, so they're out there. Whether you can say it in rap music, whether you can say it to your black friends if they say you can, like they're those conversations there. And so for me, someone saying it, even in a school context, is definitely doing it on purpose to hurt. But I mean, when I was in school, I got called the K word, and my feeling wasn't these kids need to be expelled or they need to be whatever. It was just, let's have the conversation now, because we had the conversation, but then we were punished because the way we did it was too aggressive for the girls, and they started crying. Then the teachers all came in and said, no, you guys did too much. And so for me, I just wished I had maybe a black teacher or a Luando from Including Society who could just come in and facilitate a proper conversation about why we were so upset, what that word means,
that's the key,
and why you cannot,
what
why
was
you
it
cannot
like for Lesego to hear that word, understand, because,
and what does it mean when you say that kind of word?
So you've hit on for me what is more of a worthwhile process, because these schools tend to move to like will expel and suspend and all those things. It's all punitive. Which
it's all the
me,
fear of this conversation, like you said, of being cancelled.
Yeah, but also colonial roots, because that's how we deal with dissent. You'll be punished or bad behavior. You know, you will be excommunicated.
Yeah.
And it's even more so today, because the tools of that are so much easier. We, we all have a bullhorn that we can use. But I think that for me, being able to navigate that community discussion, being able to ventilate those different views, I don't think, you know, moving to sort of like the private disciplinary process of just the two or three students involved in the matter helps. And I think it's about guiding our schools, as Savantha and I say, to be, or the people in charge, or even the students themselves, because we live in a highly reactive world.
Yeah.
You know, breaking news will come on your phone, and you're like, and you want to react to a point where, you know, you will feel like this thing is now in control of you. Whatever you've just seen, the story or the tweet or whatever it is, now is running your life. Whereas you want to get to a point where, you know, and this is the thing that attracted me to Savantika's work, of being able, I can express my anger, which I do. I'll write and say, I'm in pain over this, or I'm angry, but that anger and pain don't actually dictate what I do next. When I was younger, they would, and sometimes I wouldn't even be able to articulate that I'm angry. And you actually want to create an environment for students to be able to articulate their feelings, because I think that part of why maybe we're even bad in our social relationships, friendships and romantic relationships, because that's not part of our education.
Yeah.
You know, we give people the silent treatment, we pretend we're okay when we're not, because that's the training of what it means to be a good girl kind of thing. But it's okay to be like, actually, mom, I don't like that you just said that, and let's talk through it. But now it's kind of like you will sit in silence, go on your phone, and retell the story, and ask for even command for the person to be cancelled, or that feeling of anger that you have is going to dictate your next move, and that may not be the best move. And I know that from personal experience, like the coconut story. I was 13 or whatever. That was a highly, highly reactive moment where I grabbed my racket and I beat this boy for saying something I didn't like. In the moment, it felt like I was asserting my dominance, and I was saying to him, the bullying stops today. You will never do this again. And I remember getting home, out of breath, locked the door behind me. I called my mom, and I was like, I just beat this boy with my racket. My mom was like, good. So I come from an enabling environment of like, you got to do what you got to do. But at the same time, I had to say to my mom, but it doesn't feel good right now. Like, I just beat him in front of people. He turned me into something I don't like. But, you know, now that I'm older and I've had experiences like that, I'm able to say, it doesn't feel good when I react from that place. I want to develop other tools that I can say I'm angry, but get to the point that you just mentioned of, let's talk about why that hurt me. And you need to receive that, because in this other incident, the student was expelled before that conversation could be had. So she's removed, but she's out in the world, not even, you know,
now
contextualizing.
She's operating from her own anger.
She's bitter. There's resentment there, and the students who've been left behind kind of like maybe feel like this is the way we resolve disputes, and they think it worked, but it's just a short-term gratification.
Yeah. I mean, I'm less forgiving when it's a varsity age. I think when it's, you know,
and
peeing on a
especially
desk.
If you are a repeat offender and things like that. But, you know, part of restorative justice, because I feel like that is more of an African way of accountability and resolving disputes, is you don't get removed from society.
Yeah.
Not even a rapist. You will be there, and people will have, you know, to engage with you, which sometimes is harder because you have to listen to all the ways in which you've broken the community, and you're not going to be exiled somewhere. There's a concerted effort that you will remain part of this community. Yes, there will be accountability measures, but you're still one of us. Even through raping someone, you don't lose your place, because we believe that your humanity can be redeemed. That is a very high calling. And most of us have run out of that, because we used it in the 90s, and you're like, white people are not doing, they're not coming to the table. So it feels like we're always offering that.
That's the thing. For me, it's like,
not reciprocated.
I think at any age, anybody is you know, able to make a mistake and can be forgiven. I think rape is such a difficult one for me to think about forgiveness for. But just the fact that I need to see the work first, because it's always us offering the leaf of like, or whatever, the branch, instead of them offering it to say, this is how I'm going to do better. I don't, that's what I don't enjoy about South African landscape. It's always on the black person to forgive, whether or not there's an, even an apology.
I think it's a global way.
I'm so tired of that shit.
And I think that's I think what Angie Kroch, who's an Afrikaans writer who I admire a lot, says that in that transition moment, you know, the biggest regret is that we always saw a black man or woman extending their hand, and there's no equivalent of a white person doing the same. And I think that's the shaky foundation on which we're built. And I think it informs your question of why are they not doing their work. It's because who's the example kind of thing at a sort of national level of someone doing that work. And also now it's compounded with fear of being cancelled, because that's the discourse now, that there's no room for error. You better get it right, if not. And I think under those circumstances, nothing useful can be done.
No, I definitely agree. I think cancel culture for me, I think it was something I was very passionate about when I was much younger, but I'm definitely like, I don't see how it works from that place,
right? So that's the evolution you want to see, even in the young people that I work with in the schools, that maybe, you know, that was my approach last year, but now that I've lived through this episode and someone's being expelled and all of that, it didn't feel as good as I thought it would be a year later. Like, what did we gain from that? Mm. Are we freer? Because even with Stellenbosch, that's what they have to sit with, right? That you can remove that person there, but if you think that's the extent of your work, then you're sorely mistaken.
DM me and tell me which future guest I should be having a convo with while we sip our cocktails. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy your drink. Okay, so I want to read two quotes. I think they're yours because it was on your page and it says Luando Klaso underneath.
Okay, so if my name is on it, then it's me.
But I want to read these two quotes and then I kind of want to ask you to, like, I don't know, react. Just discuss them or react. Okay. Yeah. So the first one says, we implore white people to rid themselves of internalized white supremacist thinking without realizing that black inferiority also props up white supremacy. We have to be as intentional in ridding our society of black inferiority as we are white supremacy. The two are inextricably linked. Mm. I thought I was going to joke on that word. We cannot profess...
That's as English.
It came back. We cannot profess to abhor white supremacy without recognizing how we enable and promote black inferiority through our reckless language.
Mm.
So I actually think we should, you know, one at a time, because I think the next one is quite different.
You know... That is from an article or essay I wrote after the leader of the EFF made a comment about why he no longer, or the EFF doesn't use black lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so dismayed by that because I've been that black lawyer at a firm, and you know what it's like, you know, trying to make budget. Exceed your budget because that's how you get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
You know all the odds that you're facing. People don't really trust you with the work. You're trying to get clients on your own and not rely on your white boss to bring in, you know, the bacon and stuff.
Knowing full well that black people have to be exceptional to be equal to white averageness.
My body's just fatigued thinking about the work of a corporate lawyer, right? There's so much anxiety around it and no room for error. As you said, you must be exceptional. The mistake that you make will define you in a way that it doesn't your white counterparts and all of that.
And also define other black lawyers, because there's black business.
And that's the point I make in the article, that for Thembeka Ncubayithobe, his successes don't reflect on me. Should he fail, then that will reflect on me. Right now, he's just exceptional. He's like sitting there on his own. That's how he's viewed. But should he do or say something that's unpopular, then it's imputed on all of us. And that's the unfairness. So that just came from recognizing in that moment that I have no need to fight this person for what they're saying, but I want them to understand how it lands with me, that it's hurtful as someone who's been, you know, in that environment, that you can't be sabotaged again by your own leaders.
Mm-hmm.
It's like things are already hard enough. We don't need someone who has such a big voice, you know, a national voice, to say that black lawyers aren't as good effectively as white lawyers.
Yeah.
So I was saying there that that's an internalized racism that he's expressing that I also have, right? And I think all of us, I think the tragedy of being black in this world is that even though theoretically you know these things, the world still runs on a capitalistic system that requires you to make concessions and things like that. So you can't completely divest from this world or these schools. You have to participate, but hopefully you participating with a purpose that I'm trying to get somewhere. Even as a lawyer, you know, if you want to get somewhere, probably a white law firm, traditionally white law firm, is where you need to end up, right? And if you don't end up there, if you are taken on by a small black firm, everyone will question your experience. It can't be as good and all those things. So even in the decisions that have informed my life come from that inferiority complex, that the more removed I am from black people, the better my life will be, whether it's geographically, whether it's educationally, you know, whether it's professionally, all of those things mark progress.
Yeah.
And I think that in as much as white supremacy is the thing that is always on our tongues, we need to talk about how we have still internalized that we are inferior to white people, and it matters what they think about us. It matters that you know, we get the acknowledgement and the approval from them. It matters that they invite us into the deals and their projects and all those things. That stamp of approval from a white institution or a white person far exceeds anything a black person will say.
Yeah.
So I think that when it was surprising, because the EFF is all about, you know, a black nationalism and consciousness and all of that, and in another breath to then say that, it was like, that's how strong internalized black inferiority is. Mm-hmm. And I hope that's the discourse that they start, because for me that's also high on the political agenda. We can't always focus on the actions of white people, but all the ways in which we internalize our feelings of being less than. And one of the most consequential books I've read is Caste, and Caste is about the hierarchy that you know, aspects of our lives operate on, and that people have lesser value than others. Other people at the top of the hierarchy, whether it's the caste system as it operates in India, or the caste system that led to the Holocaust, or the caste system that defined the apartheid system, or the caste system that led to slavery and Jim Crow and all those things, is that those things are so embedded in who we are that you don't need the apartheid regime or the Holocaust to happen today for them to still very much be pervasive, right? That's the insidiousness of apartheid, that the regime is gone, but it's left the caste there. And I think that a lot of us truly believe that we belong at the back of the bus.
Lwando's book, Made in South Africa, A Black Woman's Stories of Rage, Resistance, and Progress. How do people find this book?
Follow me on Instagram, first of all, at Including Society, and Facebook, which I'm hardly on.
I don't think anyone's on Facebook anymore.
It used to be my favorite. Like, literally, I just loved Facebook. And Twitter, including underscore society, something like that. You'll find it, but it's not quite Including Society. You can find my book at all good bookstores, as my publisher likes to say, but I know that it's now sold out in a lot of them, that you're gonna have to buy through my publisher. And if you
can borrow my copy as well.
Yes, that's what I love. People who share books, it's amazing. Yeah, I know libraries have them, so some of the schools that I work with, they have them in their libraries. Yeah, but Tracy McDonald is my publisher, TM Publishers. You can look her up on Instagram and order directly from her if you can't find it at bookstores. But I think it should be there.
Thank you very much for joining me today. I did not touch this chimera because, my God, it's awful. It's awful. The next time you're coming, we're going to have something.
Oh, it'll be after my gynae appointment.
Okay, so
and
we'll
pretty much going to have great results for and we'll celebrate with a proper cocktail.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining me, and thank you everybody for listening. It has been a great pleasure. This is, I love learning, I love listening, I love Lwando. So,
oh,
I
love you too, Mr.
But yes.
And your mom.
Shout out to Penny. She's gonna love that. Alright, thank you so much and goodbye. Yeah. Convos and Cocktails, produced in partnership with Nesucho Tlhabi and WMG Rep. Drinks never end at the bar. So join me over at the socials with your cocktail, where we get to continue the conversations. Simply follow me at Lesotho Tlhabi. See you there. Recorded at Solid Gold Podcast. Solid Gold. To be understood, you must first be heard. I look forward to our next convos and cocktails. And don't forget, mo money, mojito, or whatever Biggie said.